Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to part two of News, Trends, and Stories with Dr. Joseph Farrell. We had a great conversation last week on economy and financial markets, then geopolitics and culture. There was a great deal to cover. And this week we're talking about science and technology, the unanswered questions of 2017. You know, we have a lot to discuss there. And finally, inspiration. Where do we get our inspiration? So, Joseph, welcome back to the Salyer Report. Thank you again so much for doing this. It's one of our highlights of every wrap-up is the ability to chew through all the most important stories with you once a quarter and then, of course, now once a year. And I have to tell you, there was a lot happening this year.
Yeah, there was. And thanks for having me back, Catherine.
Okay, so science and technology, there are two things that struck me about science and technology during 2016 and going into 2017. On one hand, you have tremendous, dazzling new developments in many, many different areas. But on the other hand, there are serious and growing questions of integrity. And we even see very famous scientists or scientific journalists coming out and warning about junk science. And so integrity is a real issue. And when you have technology changing rapidly combined with real integrity issues, I think it there's more than a little cause for concern. And this ties into what we were talking about last week, which was without a strong culture that can handle the kind of power and ethical issues that we're facing here, how in the world are we going to navigate?
Well, you know, the fundamental thing I think at issue with this whole junk science meme is, you know, let's take the GMO issue as an example. When GMOs began to be promoted, it was the agribusiness companies that began to do this. They used the principle of the so-called substantial equivalence. You know, it looks like corn, tastes like corn, but it's genetically modified. Well, they used that principle to ram through the acceptance of GMOs and assure the public of the safety and that they'd done all the science. Now we find out, of course, that the science is wanting. We've seen similar things happen with the global warming theme, you know, which has now changed to climate change, which is one of the most stupid labels I think you can come up with. It's a tautology. Of course the climate changes. It's always changing, you know. But the problem, Catherine, is so fundamental, and I'm glad that scientists are speaking up about it, because it's really an epistemological problem. How can you trust science when you have a corporate bias or even a government bias? What this really does is it's calling into question the integrity of the scientific process itself. And that's, right. Again, you know, this to me, Catherine, is an aspect of what we talked about last week with the corporate media, you know, just really kind of shooting itself in the foot during the last election. Because now, you know, they say that they're going to clean up their act, but now, you know, would anybody trust them? And the government's kind of in the same position. You know, they've fed us so many lies over the years. If they suddenly come out and tell the truth, would anybody trust them? This is the problem. And the only way that this can be addressed is to restore the culture, to restore the idea of virtue to the culture. You know, I'm one of those that doesn't even like the term values, because values is a wonderfully relevant Hegelian term. You know, I prefer to talk in terms of virtue, honesty, integrity, and you know, all those good things. This is what's got to be restored, and that's a cultural phenomenon. And science, whether we like it or not, even the hard sciences like physics or chemistry and so on, even these have a dependency on some cultural assumptions that, like we talked about last week. So culture is at the heart of the issue, even in science. And I'm glad that scientists are beginning to point out these things and to question some of these things. But I see another problem with the way that they're going about this, and that is the idea that some of the sciences have become so complex that they argue, well, you know, you're simply not a physicist, so you can't have any opinions about it. This is the trend I see also emerging, and I think it's a very dangerous one. Because essentially what they're saying, in effect, is that we're kind of a priesthood, and that none of our assumptions can be critically analyzed by the layman or the amateur. And in fact, if you look at some of the technology that we're going to be talking about, some of these things are being invented by amateur scientists. In other words, they're not credentialed, they don't have any tenure track position at a major university or so on. So I think there's a danger in this that also has to be scrutinized very, very carefully. We've seen, even to the extent, Catherine, of stories in the last year, and I blogged about this a couple of times, where papers were presented to respectable scientific journals that were complete gobbledygook. They had been composed on a computer, and they said absolutely nothing, but, you know, they said it in highfalutin, sophisticated sounding language, and they were accepted for publication. And of course, you know, subsequently revealed that these papers were totally meaningless. You know, the peer review process, in other words, has broken down to a certain extent. So science itself is in undergoing the same cultural phenomenon that we've seen going on elsewhere. And again, it's a result of the bastardization of culture. I can't imagine for the life of me, you know, an Isaac Newton or a Rene Descartes or a Gottfried Leibniz coming out and saying, well, I'm a scientist, I'm a mathematician, you just got to believe me and take me at my word. You know, they would have been laughed out of court had they said such a thing. And the other thing is, they would never have said it. You know, so,
right.
So we've got to get rid of this idea that there's a priestly cadre of scientists protecting their orthodoxies, which is pretty much what it's becoming in some cases. So it's a cultural phenomenon again, Catherine. We're right back to the fundamental central issue.
Well, you know, you're seeing in the financial area, where cybersecurity is so important, or in the governmental intelligence area, but also in what's now called the Internet of Things, you're seeing multiple areas in our society where the plan over the next 5 years is to do everything digitally.
Right.
And yet, at the same time, we're seeing the same exact players in business and government and the financial community say, you know, cybersecurity problems are getting worse every day, and you know, we're going to have a digital World War III.
Yeah.
And so, I've been asking this for many years, but I continue to ask the question: why are we trying to get more dependent on these systems if they have no integrity?
Well, this is again the collapse of rationality among Mr. Global, because on the one hand, they're telling us, well, you know, our systems are not secure, we're being hacked, blah, blah, blah. And at the same time, out of the other corner of their mouth, they're saying, well, we need to move to this totally digital world. And you know me, I'm extremely suspicious of that move, not only to move entirely digital financially, which I think would be a disaster. Again, I'm old-fashioned. I think there has to be a physical medium of exchange of some sort, whatever it may be.
Right.
But the other problem here is, I don't know quite how to put this, but the other problem is they're trying to digitalize the culture itself, and this is my big problem with it.
Right.
We cannot move
right.
our books and trust them to corporations, particularly. We cannot move our books, our art, our philosophy, our science entirely to the digital world. I tell my readers over and over again that the only version of my books that I regard as a canonical text is the actual hard copy, because that's the text I wrote, that's the text I intended. A corporation can go in there, if they had the mind to, I think, go in there on those ebooks and modify text, and trust me, it will come. Because
right.
you know, let's look at music, for example. We have this political correctness movement out now, So do we take all the offending passages out of Bach or Mozart or Beethoven in the name of political correctness? Do we go in and fundamentally alter the artistic creation itself? That's what is at stake. So I think people have to be extremely skeptical financially of these moves to cashless digital transactions. You know, you put in your article that the Russian Central Bank heist of over 8 million Bitcoin wallets. So, you know, this was a technology that we were assured was uncrackable.
Oh, no, that's a different... There are two articles. One is the Russian Central Bank heist. The 8 billion million Bitcoin wallets is a different article.
It's a different article. I'm sorry. I understood that. But still...
The Russian Central Bank was pure rubles.
Well, the point still remains. If they can hack into Bitcoin, you know, which is supposedly this secure, trustworthy system, then nothing is secure. And my point there is, even if corporations were not inclined to go in and alter texts that they didn't like or take out passages that they didn't like, somebody else could.
Right.
So we have to get out of our head that these systems are secure. They are not, as you pointed out and have been pointing out for a long time. And I have to give you kudos, Catherine, because you're one of the few people out there that I know of that's pointing out these things. We can't afford to turn over our financial sovereignty and our creative sovereignty to a system that is fundamentally full of holes. It just doesn't work.
Right.
If you don't believe me, just go back and think of the Sony hack. You know, this was not only a financial disaster for Sony, it was also a disaster in terms of their creativity, because now who wants to do business with them in the creative sphere? So, you know, and the same thing holds true for, you know, getting your movies off Netflix and the crowd, you know, in the cloud and so on and so forth. You know me, you've been here. I go out and buy the DVD. I want to see the movie, and I don't want anybody altering it at a later date. So,
Right. That's not, fluid copy is not what you're interested in. Well, let's turn to health freedom, because health freedom is the area that really frustrates me the most. And I'll start with vaccines. I just put a new, the team that did Vaxxed, and I'll give it away today. We have a movie and documentary of the year, and Vaxxed won documentary of the year for 2016 on the Solari Report. I don't know if you've had the opportunity to see it, but it's just quite extraordinary. The Vax team, after they finished the documentary and published it, have been traveling the country, and they're doing more interviews and collecting more stories on vaccinations. And I just put one up about a family named the McDowell who had triplets, took the triplets in to get vaccinated, and all three of them came down with autism almost immediately after getting the vaccine.
I can believe it.
And it's an extraordinary story, and their doctor fired them because they wouldn't continue to give the children more vaccines.
Right.
If you can believe that.
I can.
Anyway, it's an unbelievable, when you watch the story. What I don't understand, if you look at the latest polls, Joseph, the number of people who understand the danger of vaccinations and heavy schedules of vaccinations is still remarkably small. And one of the things I deal with at the Solari Report is we put up something in 2016 where one of our subscribers said, you know, I can't persuade my children not to vaccinate my grandchildren, and I can't get them to understand the dangers of this. So we went out and did a review of all the material and came back and said, here's the best material to share with them. And yet they're walking into tremendous, and this is happening throughout our subscriber base, is they're walking into tremendous problems with people that they love, people in their family, children around them, not necessarily their children, but, you know, sort of neighbors' children's or grandchildren. They can't get through. And yet the evidence of the dangers of vaccines is so compelling. We finally had a breakthrough in 2016 because at the debates, Trump just brought up the fact that, you know, if you look at what had happened to this beautiful child that he knew of, you know, boom, 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 suddenly, you know, vaccine, suddenly autistic, you know, heavy schedules are dangerous. It took tremendous courage to do that. It was the first thing Trump did that got me to sort of take him seriously as a candidate. Anyway, and I remember Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who's highlighted in Vaxxed, had spoken personally with Trump and had taken the position this was the only candidate we had any hope of getting any reversals of this stuff. So what is happening with vaccines? Why does Mr. Global want, you know, basically to destroy the population with this stuff? We're talking about things that are very physically dangerous, are not necessary to do the things in many cases that we are told they do. You know, what is going on here?
Well, that opens up such a huge Pandora's box of high-octane speculation. I'll tell you, I think there are several agendas here. I'm old enough, and you're old enough, and probably many of our listeners are old enough to remember back when doctors would not and steadfastly refused to vaccinate young infants and children with these large vaccine cocktails that they're giving out now, precisely for the reason that the immune system of an infant or a child isn't sufficiently developed to ward off these negative effects. You know, I remember this very vividly. I remember my parents debating whether or not to give me the polio vaccine. And back then we had a choice. And this really is, I think, the heart of the issue is sovereignty over your own body or your children, you know, to watch out for them. I did a blog recently on my website about a study that had been submitted to a medical journal that was compiled by various doctors around the world, some of them from India and so on, based on the stories of mothers of children who had received vaccines, these big vaccine cocktails that they're dishing out now, and who had subsequently developed various symptoms on the autism spectrum, all right? And some of them were mild and some were very severe, but they collected all of these stories and submitted this paper as proof that there were very, very serious effects to these vaccines that needed to be examined. The paper was initially accepted for publication and then subsequently withdrawn after pressure had been put on the journal by, of course, Big Pharma. And I pointed out in the blog that what this really did was it short-circuited the entire diagnostic process as we have known it in medicine. Why? Because when you go into a doctor relies on the patient's descriptions of what they have observed, what they're feeling, what they're experiencing, either with themselves or with parents in the case of their children. And this is part of the diagnostic process. This is how doctors determine what sort of therapeutic means that they want to employ with their patients. And for a paper to be rejected because this same sort of anecdotal evidence was presented en masse, to me, is a clue to how completely the scientific process is being short-circuited. We're back to culture. We're back to integrity again. We're dealing with a system, a medical system, and a scientific process that has no integrity because the corporations have gained such control over the supposedly independent government outlets and so on and so forth. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, as far as I can see, Catherine, is I think that this move to remove your medical sovereignty from you, the individual, and this to me has always been the big danger of Obamacare. The move to do this, I think, disguises yet another problem, because they can put almost anything in those vaccines and not tell you. And I don't put it past them to do this.
Right.
They have deliberately lied and covered up the autism link to vaccines. They are telling us that, oh, that little bit of mercury in the vaccine isn't going to hurt you, and on and on and on it goes. The real danger I see in this, Catherine, is that they could be planning to slip something else in those vaccines, be it a microchip of some sort that you're not told is there. I've already heard stories that this is already being done in places without people's knowledge or consent. The other thing I think is possible is that they could be injecting some sort of chemical or genetic marker in these things for the purposes of depopulation, you know, put something in people that will make them sick if the other agent is introduced at a later date. That's an old trick. The Borgias were experts at it. And I can even see to a certain extent that this is being used as yet another way for them to collect DNA samples. You know, the sky's the limit here, and this is why we have to insist on the patient's right, on the parent's right, to sovereignty over their own body. Period.
Well, but help me out. Why, if you look at the hard evidence, documentaries, case studies, videos,
right.
Peer-reviewed articles, transcripts, books of the dangers of vaccines, why are so many parents and families ignoring the facts? Why do they continue to buy?
I think it's very simple. I think it's because in the public school system, and I remember this myself, in elementary school growing up, we would learn about Jenner and so on and the smallpox vaccine and how wonderful all of this stuff was. So I think to a certain extent people are indoctrinated to think this way. And the other reason I think is that there has been kind of a philosophical sea change in the study of medicine from the period that you and I were growing up to now. Back then, a physician was really a physician. You went to your local GP, and you know he had to have a broad knowledge of medicine so that if he determined that you needed a specialist of some sort, he would refer you to somebody. And back then, there wasn't this push to get you popping this or that pill or taking this or that shot. They were much more reticent to wield these things. And I think to a certain extent, we're looking at the influence of the big pharmaceutical corporations on the medical schools in this country, because, of course, they endow many of them or they contribute money to them. So this gives them influence over the curriculum itself. So I think you've seen a new crop of doctors being churned out that are much less critical of the so-called science behind the vaccines. And many of them, in my experience, with a few exceptions, many of them don't even know that the contrary science is even out there. So,
right.
You know, this is the other problem with these professional peer-reviewed journals, because many times even these journals are getting money and funding from some of these corporations, and they're not therefore legitimately independent journals, as was the case with this study that I mentioned that I blogged about. So we're dealing with a cultural phenomenon of corruption, of mercantilist policies that have just run amok. And you know, we first of all have to get people used to the idea that they can have their own opinions about anything. You know, they don't need to be an expert in something.
I think this is more than greed.
Yeah.
One of the best presentations I've ever seen was the one you gave at Secret Space Program 2015 about treaty obligations.
Right.
And you went through Versailles and the treaty obligations and the extent to which the leadership of the German society had no choice but to implement the treaty obligations.
Right.
And if you look at the implementation of this, to me it looks like a treaty obligation.
Yeah, it looks to me the same way. There's some pressure coming from somewhere to force people to do this. And you know, you later in your outline here have the mention of the bill that the House of Representatives just passed to microchip people with mental disabilities. And again, I think this is nothing but the camel's nose in the door.
Well, it's really funny. I had one Twitter follower give me a hard time because they said, well, it's just for grants to help local guys, if they want to do it. And I had to give them a little lecture about, you know, sort of how you phase what you want in through the 26-step process. You know, you start with grants and building the infrastructure and, you know, on and on and on. But where it goes absolutely is trying to microchip the whole population. This is just how you sneak up on them.
Right. Well, you know, microchip them for what? Is this going to be part of the, mark of the beast financial system? Is this going to be to track everybody and monitor everybody? In other words, again, the issue is individual sovereignty. And the whole problem here is if we're dealing with digital systems that can be hacked, would you want a microchip that can be hacked? they want to hack everything. They want total control over humanity. And this, again, goes back to your observation that we're really dealing now with an ideological struggle between inhumanity and humanity. And, I've got bad news for the global only crowd. I'll be damned if I will take any microchip willingly or voluntarily or knowingly. I will not do it. You can throw me in jail. You can chop off my head, but you cannot force me to do it. I absolutely will not. And it's not a matter of religion. It's a matter of my freedom. It's a matter of me being able to preserve my humanity and creativity. That's what it's about.
Well, here's the reality. The African-American slave trade was canceled for two reasons. One is they couldn't succeed at putting down the rebellion in Haiti, and it scared everybody to death. And I think it's one of the reasons Haiti right now is going through such a difficult period. You know, we're looking at payback. Yep. So that's number one. But the second reason was they couldn't find a way to perfect the collateral, and the slave owners kept selling slaves westward, and the banks kept losing money.
Yep.
But as soon as you can microchip a human being, you can perfect collateral.
Yes.
And
here's
the reality. The reality is the people who run the American establishment, in my personal experience, believe in slavery. They practice slavery. Now, most of their slavery has been done with mind control, but if presented with the ability to perfect the collateral, will they institute slavery? You betcha. Now, will they use physical force or just mind control? You know, I don't know which concoctions they have planned. But
well, I'll tell you, this is a very important insight, Catherine, that you're having, because this goes directly again to my Versailles template model. Because in effect, what you're doing by microchipping people is you're collateralizing them.
Right.
And this raises the question, well then, why is it necessary to collateralize humanity?
Because they're trying to make up for the collateral fraud in the system.
Yeah, bingo.
Bingo, right. Which is why I keep asking the question, who really owns the debt? Right, because if you own enough of the debt, then you can force these kinds of treaty obligations.
Exactly.
Right.
And I have a suspicion that whoever is putting forth the lien, so to speak, may be very old and not necessarily on this planet.
Well, that's why I keep following back who owns the debt, because I want to stop the treaty obligations. So
well, yeah, you know, this brings up, you know, this business of collateralizing space and why they're passing these laws. Because it looks to me, you know, to crawl way out onto the end of the twig of high-octane speculation here and speculate far beyond the ability of the evidence to sustain it. It still feels and looks to me as if they are putting into place all the mechanisms legally, financially, and so on to challenge whoever may be holding that debt. That's the way it's looking to me.
I hope so. So let's turn to EMF radiation, because EMF radiation, we did a great Solaria report with Jason Bodensmith on EMF radiation. Jason is a environmental scientist who has had great success starting environmental consultancies and other businesses related to cleaning up the environment. And he decided about a year ago to look into EMF radiation and is now announced that he's dedicated to spending the rest of his life protecting the planet from it, because he thinks it could literally destroy the planet.
Yes.
So, you know, this whole infrastructure of digitizing everything and using that to manage all sorts of flows, let alone to control, all depends on these electromagnetic frequencies that are having devastating impacts on a variety of different people and living things' health.
Yes.
And it's quite invisible. People have a hard time believing it's really a problem because it's so invisible. And it's also very new. And what's the history of suppressing the information about the risks of EMF and what we can do to protect ourselves from EMF, you know, this is another area like the vaccines where you're seeing unbelievable suppression and censorship.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I'll tell you, I have a friend that has Morgellons disease. And he has, as his personal physician advisor for this, Dr. Hildegard Stavanger, who's done a lot of research into this, and he has had his lesions, had tissue samples taken from some of his lesions. And I've seen pictures of these things, Catherine, and quite literally, there's plastic growing in these things. Now, this is not
right.
Natural. This is not normal.
Oh, I think they're antenna.
Oh, yes. That's exactly what he
yeah.
thinks, and that's exactly what she thinks, because during periods of high EMF radiation in the background, he's absolutely, and I've seen it for myself, he's absolutely doubled over in pain. He says it's like having thousands of ants crawling inside your skin.
Right.
And, you know, and that's a very, you know, that's a very dramatic form of this. But there's another thing, and you and I have talked about this privately. I've just heard from a friend today that people at certain times during a week, and I've experienced this firsthand, seem just tired for no reason whatsoever.
Right.
You know, I'm a fairly energetic person, as are you, but I go through periods on occasion, and they're never predictable, where I'm just tired and exhausted and want to do nothing but sleep, and there's no reason for it. There's no reason for it.
It's the gray goo.
Yeah, it's the gray goo. It's something electromagnetic, and I'm convinced that this is an issue that we have to somehow make much more public and visible than is currently the case, because there is something going on. And part of it, I think, is just accidental, the byproduct of the fact that our society is now so dependent on electromagnetic radiation technologies. But part of it, I do think, is quite deliberate. So
right.
I'm on board with you here. I think this is a huge issue. It's a huge health issue. It's a huge environmental issue. And we're going to have to start paying attention to it. We're dealing with a technology that we still, to this day, don't really fully understand.
Right.
And that's the other aspect of this.
Well, this is why I'm so concerned about the Chuck E. Cheese and the mall brawls. Because
yes.
I want Jason to make a little sort of metal gizmo that when everybody starts punching each other, I can slip my phone into that gizmo and
right.
make sure I'm not contributing to the brawl. Okay, so let's turn to robots.
Well, let me add one thing there. Let me add one thing there. This is a perfect area for people to be creative and
yes.
start inventing the devices that can turn this off. Somebody's already come out with goggles and things that you can wear that defeat the surveillance cameras. So in other words, you know,
right.
The market's playing again. So this is another area, I think, where we have a tremendous opportunity for people that are technically and scientifically inclined to investigate this and invent gadgets and devices that can help protect people against it.
Right.
It's hugely important, I think, that we do so.
I've had tremendous success with several gadgets, and in our Solaria report with Jason, he goes through many sort of how-tos and what to do. There's a great amount of things you can do, but you really have to sit down and realize, okay, there's this invisible force. I need to take it into account and then start seeing what works for you.
Right.
Okay, so robots and artificial intelligence. I did a wonderful Solaria report this year with Jay Dyer, and we picked out all the movies that we thought were the best to explain, you know, the movies that teach you the most about mind control and how mind control is used in society. And we were about halfway through and we realized, oh my God, you know, if you look at all these movies, they're seeing how human they can make robots and how robotic they can make humans, almost as if they're prototyping to see which works better for what.
Yes. It's gone so far that they even have sex robots now.
I know.
You know, talk about nutty. But yeah, I agree. And again, this is that great ideological divide that we're facing in our culture. Do we want a human culture or an inhuman one? Well, clearly Mr. Global wants an inhuman one. You know, John D. Rockefeller, I don't want people to be educated. I want workers, you know.
Right.
So it's the reduction of humanity to the hive. And the only way to combat this, quite frankly, is, again, the human creativity aspects of culture. Robots are not going to compose the Hallelujah Chorus or Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony or what have you. They're just not going to do it because those are human products born out of the human soul. And this is what Mr. Global lacks, because he doesn't even believe in something called the soul. And all of this at the same time that physicists are increasingly getting out of the materialist paradigm altogether. So, you know, science is driving one way and the global technocrats are driving in the opposite direction. So it's a huge issue. I don't even know where to begin. AI, quite frankly, Catherine, I think AI is already here.
I agree. I think AI is here and is having a tremendous impact.
Yes.
I also think that the way to cope with this kind of technology, I agree with you, creativity offers tremendous workarounds and ways of combating it. But I think we each have to make a decision in our life to use this technology to build up humanity,
right,
and to have nothing to do with that which debases or destroys humanity.
Right.
And this is going to have to be, you know, if you look at the enforcement mechanism we need in the future, it's going to have to be one person at a time making that choice in their time, their money, and how they function. Environmental stress, I wanted to bring that up because we're watching, I think, unprecedented, you know me, I don't believe a word of anybody who comes up with the global warming and climate change stuff, only because they refuse to incorporate a lot of very important phenomena and data. But I think environmental stress is a great danger and very serious.
Yes.
So, and we continue to see frightening things. So whether it's what's happening at Fukushima continue to dump into the oceans, or nuclear plants, toxic waste have no way to be dealt with, or garbage in the Shanghai water supply. I think the most frightening one was the professor who came out with studies proving that toxic nanoparticles were being discovered in human brains. I'm assuming that's the global spring.
Yep.
There seems to be surprisingly little action at the governmental level or corporate level on addressing the environmental challenges, and I wonder why.
I have to wonder why, too. To me, Catherine, it's baffling that the Japanese response to Fukushima was so lame and tame. Because if we turn the clock back about 20 years, of course, you had the Chernobyl meltdown. And, you know, there were Russians that went in there and sacrificed their lives to shut that down.
Right.
And they, you know, they were made national heroes, rightfully so, for doing so. You know, the Russian response was much more immediate, much more aware of the danger, and the Japanese response seemed to be so tepid and faltering. And that's not to say that there weren't brave Japanese that went in there and sacrificed their...
Oh, there were very... The Fukushima 50 were very brave.
Yeah, they were. What perplexes me is that on the one hand, we see enormous breakthroughs in the last year in fusion technology. The Germans were successful for a second time with their very peculiar design for a fusion reactor. And they've completed enough proof of concepts experiments now that I think they're getting ready to, you know, go full power and see if they can't produce more energy out of it than they're putting into it. There were successes in South Korea as well in fusion technology. So I have to wonder personally, and have always wondered, and I've always been extremely skeptical of the fission nuclear power that produces all this deadly waste and has so many problems with it, as to why you have a continuing policy in some countries, this one included, of pressing nuclear power. This is fission power. It's incredibly dangerous. But the other thing, I think, dealing with environmental stress here, that since we're talking about fusion in this connection, and, you know, we could go on and on, we have yet to have a government acknowledge that the spraying is even taking place, when it's very clear
right
by now that to anyone that's investigated it, that it is taking place. I have to wonder why this is the case, and the only thing that I can come up with, Catherine, is that there is some covert purpose to it, and I don't think that it's depopulation. I think it has to do with trying to weaponize the planet in some form or fashion, because if you look at least as far as I've been able to gather, if you look at some of the heavy metals that apparently are involved in the spraying, in particulate form, you're dealing with just some astonishing stuff. I've seen reports of aluminum silicate. I've seen reports of barium, of all things, things of this sort. And the only thing that I can think of that they're doing this for is if you are spraying all of that heavy metal into the atmosphere, along with, you know, plastic nanoparticles that turn into antenna inside of Morgellon lesions, what they're trying to do is they're trying to increase the electrical conductivity of the atmosphere for some reason. And
right.
The only two things I can think of there is, on the one hand, they might be trying somehow to strengthen the Earth's magnetic field, because it's been weakening rather dramatically in recent years.
Right.
Many people think it's getting ready for a magnetic pole shift, which has happened, you know, according to the geological record previously in history, to increase the strength of the magnetic field, so that, you know, we're not getting bombarded with all sorts of bad things from the sun. But the other thing that I think might be going on in this respect is, by increasing the electrical conductivity of the atmosphere, you're increasing the efficiency of any sort of energy weapons that you might be trying to deploy, either on the surface of the planet or up in space. So, you know, either way, it's not a very good agenda. And I think, you know, when you put it in those terms, I think people have to start demanding from governments from, you know, begin at the state level, you know, put it through the state legislature and pressure Congress and the government or your local parliament, wherever you may be in the world, to start providing some serious answers to this, because it's a huge environmental risk. It's a huge health risk. And we need some answers from people, and we need them now.
Well, frankly, what you're doing is you're digitizing everything. You're digitizing the atmosphere, and then you're digitizing all living things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
It's you know, to crawl way out on the limb again, Catherine, the other possibility here is they're doing some sort of terraforming. But
right.
the question then is, well, terraforming for what? What sort of life forms would need that?
Right.
It's
very interesting. I listened to a history of DARPA this year, and you would listen to them develop, for example, a digital face to deal with the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Vietnam, and then you would realize, oh, that was the first invention that evolved ultimately into what Elena Friedland now calls the space fence. But you would see the development of the first drones and the development of all the stuff that just blossoms into, you know, the hubris to digitize the entire planetary atmosphere.
Yep.
Okay, well, with that, let's turn to CERN and particle accelerators, because in addition to CERN, we have China saying they're going to build one twice as big.
Mm-hmm.
Which raises the question that we keep asking, and nobody does it better than you, which is, what in the world is CERN really?
Well, to me, CERN has several levels, all of them problematical. But the first one is really epistemological, and you know, it's interesting to me that the Chinese want to build their own bigger version of it, and now the Russians have jumped on the bandwagon. They want to build one too. Germany has plans for a very different kind of accelerator that they want to build. The problem with CERN, from a purely philosophical, epistemological point of view, is that it's the only structure, it's the only machine of its type currently in existence. So in other words, the science is all about repeatability and independent verification. Well, how do you verify independently the pronouncements that CERN is coming out with? Obviously, you know, you and I can't go into our garage and build a cyclotron and, you know, test it for ourselves. So I think this is the first thing that gives me the question of, are they really telling us what they are really finding? I think this is the reason the Chinese want to build their own. And they're big participants in CERN. But I think even there, the Chinese realize that there's probably something here that we're not being told, or that's not being shared with us, that's being kept from us. That's the surface level. Then we have the public explanation of CERN, that what we're doing is we're smashing hadrons together, and hadrons are simply heavy particles like protons and neutrons and so on. In other words, they're not nearly massless particles like quarks or electrons or things of this nature. But what they're telling us is that this is all about particle physics, that we're smashing all of this stuff together so that we can learn more about the states of matter in the first few nanoseconds after the Big Bang, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we're supposed to believe this, but my problem has always been, and again, I want to emphasize for people, I'm not a scientist. I'm simply a guy looking at what they're saying and what the machine is and certain facts about the machine, and I'm coming up with a different conclusion. CERN has the Hadron Collider itself, the final circular accelerator, has a proton stream that's injected into it that's been sped up to high energies in four previous accelerators. Okay, so the Hadron Collider is really a set of five particle accelerators, the last of which, before the Hadron Collider itself, is also a circular collider. All right, it's a proton synchrotron. And the collider itself rotates the proton stream in opposite directions at the same time. So in my thinking, you have tremendous possibility there for some torsion effects. And torsion simply is the idea that space itself sort of twists. If you can kind of imagine an empty soda pop can and then you wring it like a dish rag in your hands, this is what torsion does to the geometry of local space where it's found, all right? So on that big of a scale, I think you could be getting some torsion effects that are not within the small ranges that nature itself produces. I think it's very possible that you're getting some artificial and very large torsion effects. But the other, and for me, the big problem with CERN is that the magnets in that device and in the detectors on the device are several times stronger than the local magnetic field of the planet. And there have been people tracing the effects when CERN is turned on of the magnetosphere of the planet. And it appears to dip and weaken when CERN is turned on. So in other words, this machine could be producing, in my opinion, planetary resonance effects due to the sheer scale of the magnetic fields involved. And that means, in turn, that it could be having an effect on the interior dynamo of the planet itself. And that, in turn, means that since the Earth's magnetic field and the Sun's magnetic field actually touch physically out in space, that you might be getting some sort of resonance effects in the Sun itself, all right? So, in other words, I'm viewing CERN in almost exactly the opposite fashion than what we've been told. We're being told it's all about the physics of the very small and crashing particles and so on together. I think that the machine, just by dint of those strong magnetic fields, is actually a machine for manipulating planetary effects, that it can do this, all right? And that means that I suspect that there's a secret level to the project that is being kept entirely hidden from public view. Now, once we accept all of that, then I think there's an even deeper level to it. If you look at the sheer computational power that CERN needs, you're literally creating billions of bits of data every second. So in other words, CERN is the largest user of computational power on the planet. It's also the largest user of the internet on the planet, because the computers were programmed by the scientists to pick out and notice certain patterns in particle collisions. In other words, the computers are doing the initial selection of the data that the scientists subsequently examine and analyze, all right? This means, to my mind, that it is possible, if you accept the thesis, that this might be a planetary machine. In other words, a machine of the physics of the very large rather than the very small. If you accept that hypothesis, then it is possible, in my thinking, that there is a secret level to the computer algorithms that are pulling out data from these collisions and passing them to secret scientific committees for analysis. And I strongly suspect that if that's the case, that some of the types of data that they're looking at are what I call data correlations. In other words, when the machine is turned on, do we see noticeable geophysical effects in the planet, such as in the magnetosphere that some amateurs are tracking on YouTube? Do we see changes in the surface temperature of the corona of the Sun? Do we see changes in stellar activity, and so on and so forth? And even to the extent, do we see changes in aggregate human behavior such as behavior on markets, which can be easily watched by computers, and so on and so forth. So I think that the possibility exists that there is a huge data correlation experiment going on in conjunction with CERN, because if it has an effect on the magnetic cavity of the planet, then that means in turn, since all life on the planet, including human life, is entrained to the Schumann resonance of the planet, then changing that resonance is going to have an effect on human behavior. So in a certain sense, it's even kind of a mind manipulation device, although certainly not intended to be such, but I think that they're smart enough to realize that that's a possibility. So I think there's several levels to CERN, Catherine, that are very, very disturbing. And my real point of arguing this case is a Hungarian electrical engineer back prior to World War II that emigrated to this country. His name was Gabriel Krohn. He eventually ended up as chief research director for General Electric. So this guy was no slouch, okay? If you read Krohn's works, they're highly mathematical. They're very dense works. But in effect, what Krohn stated was effectively that the tensor calculus that Einstein used for general relativity could also be used to explain electrical machines. Now, if you parse that carefully, what Krohn has just told you is that electrical circuits of any sort, be it the very simple things that can power an alarm clock to very complex electrical circuits like CERN, that each and every one of them is a hyperdimensional device, because it can only be explained mathematically in more than three spatial dimensions. So in other words, if you apply Krohn to CERN, you're dealing with a hyperdimensional machine that could conceivably tap into and access the energies of more than three spatial dimensions. Okay? Now that's a whopper, because that means in effect that another purpose of the machine is to prove the actual existence of those higher dimensions and their energetic effects in three dimensions. And CERN recently, you know, this was right about the time that I published The Third Way. Scientists at CERN came out and admitted, yes, we're also looking for evidence of higher dimensions. Well, yeah, duh, because you're dealing with a higher dimensional machine to begin with. So, you know, there's several levels of this thing, Catherine, and they're all disturbing. These people are playing around by their own admission, even in the particle physics stuff, by their own admission, are playing around with cosmic forces and quite literally with cosmology.
Could they also be playing interdimensionally?
Sure, absolutely. That's precisely what higher dimensions means. If you want a simple illustration of why this so concerns me, not to coin a pun, but think of higher dimensions like water that is trapped behind a big dam, like the Hoover Dam, okay? Energy in higher dimensions is like water in a dam. You have a tremendous energy potential, and all you have to do is open the sluice gate, and all of that energy comes tumbling down into this reality, all right? So you're dealing with energies that theoretically would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. It's tremendously dangerous stuff, and this ultimately is my biggest concern about CERN. I've never bought for a moment that this device did not have some sort of hidden military purpose, because you're playing with forces of that magnitude and learning how to play with them. This is why I'm so concerned about it. This is why I think the Chinese want to build, you know, their own version of it, and why I think the Russians want to build their own version of it. It's a tremendously disturbing device.
I, you know, it's funny because it's one of these projects where I think a lot of the people working in it have no idea exactly why it's happening. It's very good.
Yeah, I do too. I, you know, Catherine, it's good that you mentioned that because it reminds me of something that I left out of my response to your question, and that is back when they first turned CERN on. There were court cases in Germany and the United States that attempted to prevent them from turning it on, quite literally, and the courts threw the cases out because they said they had no jurisdiction over it. So the other thing about CERN is we need to remember that this is a sovereign entity. This is
right.
A little country consisting of a particle accelerator, okay?
Right. So no courts have jurisdiction.
Yeah, they didn't have jurisdiction over it. But the other thing that really concerned me is when they turned it on and then suddenly turned it off, okay? We were told that the reason that they turned it off was because somehow the magnetic field had failed, the particle stream had pierced one of the cooling tanks. They have these big, huge liquid helium cooling tanks around the entire circumference of the magnets because they generate such enormous amounts of heat that they had to quickly turn it off because one of the cooling tanks had been pierced by the particle stream. In other words, it's like punching a hole in the balloon. And I thought that there was something fishy about that story, and to this day I still think this. I have no evidence for this, but I suspect when they first turned it on and powered it up, that what they did was they invented a cover story as to why they shut it down. Now, I have no doubt that the cooling tanks ruptured, but the real question is, why did they rupture? If you go back to what CERN is, what the collider is, with those counter-rotating, tremendously energetic proton streams in magnetic fields that are, you know, rotating in contrary motion itself, I think what they did was they created a much bigger torsion effect than they had gambled on. And that the entire device was literally creating kind of a, I don't know what else to call it, but kind of a local field distortion in celestial space that was putting the machine under tremendous stress that they had not counted on, and that they had to go in and reconfigure the thing under the pretext of repairing a helium cooling tank. Follow me?
Right. Well, the danger is we're not only pumping and dumping the planetary financial markets, we're literally pumping and dumping the planet.
Yeah, not just the planet. We're pumping and dumping the...
The field, the electromagnetic field.
Yeah,
right.
the local planetary field. I think they didn't count on this, and that was the cover story that they put out. Because, again, I'm very, very suspicious of this whole thing, and I think that event, quite frankly, Catherine, is the reason the Chinese want to build their own and even... you know, twice as big as CERN, because the Chinese they're not stupid, and they know of the existence of dynamic torsion, and I can just bet you that there's probably a secret analysis in the Chinese government somewhere that's saying something similar to what I'm proposing. Any way you look at it, CERN looks to me like a gigantically huge version of the Nazi Bell with the counter-rotation there, and of Richter's experiments in Argentina with rotating plasma and Lemoore precession frequency. You know, if you can imagine that scaled up to the size of the planet, then you've got a big problem. So, yeah.
Well, let's turn to the future of energy, because there's some good news there. We've seen new... sort of developments, both the Germans you mentioned and MIT on the nuclear fusion and cold fusion. But we've also seen renewables improve in efficiency to the point where many claim that they're now competitive economically with coal. And, of course, we see Asia still enormously dependent on coal in a way that is very tough on the atmosphere. terrible pollution in China and India. So renewables significantly getting more efficient, fusion coming on, all sorts of claims about breakthrough energy, which, and we know, of course, the EM space drive is going on. So a lot seems to be percolating in the energy area.
I'm so glad that you mentioned fusion and EM space drive in the same breath. I really am. I can't tell you how tickled I am. Let's start with the EM space drive for a moment, because the popular press is putting out the idea that, that this invention, it's a British engineer by the name of Roger Sawyer that invented this thing. They've been putting out this idea that this thing is in fundamental contradiction to the laws of physics. And you can go on YouTube, and for those of your listeners that are technically inclined, you can go on YouTube and Google EM Drive Roger Sawyer, where he himself walks you through the physics and the mathematics of what he's doing and why he came up with it. And, you know, there's nothing whatsoever in his thinking or in his mathematics that is contrary to any of the known laws of physics. He just applied them in a very unique way. Okay, so there we have creativity again. But what I found really interesting this last year, I actually blogged about this a couple weeks ago, the Chinese claim that they have already sent an EM drive up into space and tested it. And lo and behold, yeah, they discovered this thing is generating actual thrust. Okay, well, duh, of course it is. What I found interesting, and what's interesting to contemplate here, is that the Chinese, number one, admitted that they had done this, you know, prior to NASA doing it. NASA's still talking about it. The Chinese went and did it, okay? And I have no doubt that they did. What I suspect is that the Chinese made the announcement because they have been experimenting with the actual cavity itself, the cavity shape, to see what's the most efficient design. And they've indicated that they're going to continue researching and developing this thing. So in other words, what I suspect is the Chinese know a lot more than they're saying.
Right.
If they're willing to stake the future of their satellites on this technology, that means that there's much more here than meets the eye.
Right.
With space in mind, let's go to fusion for a moment. Because I strongly suspect, Catherine, and I'm saying something here for the first time that I haven't said anywhere else before, but I've been thinking it for a very, very long time. Fusion technology, if it can be made to work, would obviously be a kind of over the coefficient of performance of one. In other words, it's a so-called over-unity device, but not really. I use the more technical term coefficient of performance so I don't upset a lot of physicists, okay? But fusion would immediately, at once, if made practical and workable, overnight change the energy of the planet from fossil fuels, from environmentally polluting things, from dangerous nuclear fission power with all of its bad radioactive waste, to a very clean, efficient source of energy. The bad thing that they're not telling you is if the containment field, the magnetic containment field of these big, huge, hot fusion reactors were suddenly to fail, that plasma would be kind of like it would explode, quite frankly, is what you'd have. You'd have a little kind of miniature H-bomb meltdown, kind of an H-bomb fizzle, if you will. So that's what they're not telling you. That's the bad thing. So they have to, you know, presumably they're coming up with safeguards and backup speeches and so on and so forth. But there's another thing that I think is going on with fusion and the race now that we see happening between this country, Germany, and South Korea and China and so on, Russia, to develop fusion, and that's space. Because if you can learn to use fusion for power, you can also use it for propulsion.
Right.
And that means say goodbye to the chemical rocket. You would have a much faster vehicle, and you would have an efficiency of thrust that could power very, very large space vehicles. We're not talking 3 astronaut space capsules anymore, folks. So I think the hidden reason that they're pushing fusion power is space related, and that this is why you see all the talk about asteroid mining and so on and so forth. Because let's face it, I've said it before, I'll say it again, chemical rockets just ain't gonna do the job. If you're going to go out and lasso an asteroid and haul it to the moon to mine it, you have to have a pretty big ship, and you have to have pretty good thrust efficiency to move that puppy.
Right.
So look at EM drive, look at fusion. I think this is what we're slowly seeing them leak to us, and this is what I think fusion is really ultimately all about, is not just energy on this planet, but propulsion to the local planets in the solar system, if not beyond.
Okay. Okay, so you're ready for the unanswered questions of 2017?
Yep.
Okay. If you want to give percentages, that's great. If you don't, you don't have to. These, you know, just to make a comment here, these are things that we think and talk about all the time.
Right.
Okay, so turning the Titanic, can the United States of America, with the help of the new administration, turn the Titanic from a negative return on investment to taxpayers, or will it be prioritization?
I think it's going to be, there may be some prioritization at certain points along the way, but ultimately I think it can be turned. I think it's going to take 2 administrations to do it, but I think if we're looking at a second Trump term, I think it can be done, and I think it will be bumpy. I mean, turning an ocean liner, traveling along at 25 knots, you know, the ship is going to shudder and shake as you're doing it a bit. But
right.
I think it can be done, and I think it will be done. It has to be. Let's put it this way. We have no other choice. Whether you're
right, we have no other choice.
Yeah, we have no
right.
other choice. We've got to turn it.
Right. Well, but if you talk to the number of people who are talking like pigs or scaredy cats, you know, scorpions tend to not show their colors. But for it to work, we have to believe it can work.
Yes, absolutely.
So, yeah, and it means we're also going to have to turn. It's not just turning government money. We're going to have to turn the culture.
Yes. Bingo.
So this is a big turn. Okay, will the U.S. achieve a new detente with Russia, and what will it mean for the Judeo-Christian world?
Well, I think that to me is the most interesting question. Number one, again, I think it has to, simply as a counterpoise to China, and simply if we're going to be serious about fighting radical Muslim terrorism, I see no alternative. But the other thing is, I see no alternative to achieving some sort of detente with Russia, because we simply cannot afford this global empire anymore. We have to make some strategic choices and selections. And,
right.
you know, Russia's part of our culture and has been hugely influential in it. And we need to, you know, we need to recover the friendliness of relations that we had with Russia back in the 19th century and restore that and expand on it. I think it's going to be, in a certain sense, an inevitability. particularly given some of the people that Trump has selected for people around him, and the way that Mr. Putin has been very craftily and cagily non-responding to Obama recently. I do think it's going to happen, but it's not going to happen all at once. I think it's going to be kind of a prolonged thing. There will be some initial discussions about security issues, the Middle East, and cooperation, and I think probably an eventual abandonment of this ridiculous sanctions regime. and I think there's a strong possibility, if things work out, that there can be some good cooperation internationally in space with the Russians. We're already seeing some quiet discussions between the U.S. military and the Russian military, even as all of this tension publicly is occurring. There's been some quiet discussions between the two militaries, and I think that's a good thing. So I think it has to be turned. Again, this is another Titanic course we've been on, and the reemergence of Kissinger into the scene, saying what he's saying, Brzezinski coming out and admitting, you know, the unipolar game is up, it's over, we've got to do something different. I think this is a huge signal from Mr. Global, only that even they recognize that things have to change with Russia.
Okay, U.S. dollar is reserve currency. What's the future? But with that, will the EU come apart, and what does that mean for the euro?
That one's another interesting one. I give it about a 50-50 either way at this juncture. I think, you know, Germany, like it or not, you know, Germany's the locomotive of Europe, and Merkel's in trouble. Her whole policy agenda, her fiscal blunders because of it, and the recent sudden shifts in her cabinet that she's made, the sudden turnabout on some of her policy statements. She's in trouble. She knows she's in trouble. It all depends largely on the German and French elections, and I give it about a 50-50 chance. If France, the real key here, I think, is going to be France, Italy, Spain, those countries, for the very simple reason that if Marine Le Pen, even if she doesn't get elected, if her party gets any sort of substantial representation in the French Parliament, then you're going to see policy changes in France, like it or not. Even if she does not end up in the Elysee, you're going to see some huge changes in France. And that's going to spill over into Spain in a major way, where you've seen internal pressures in Spain for secession of Catalonia and so on that are fed up basically for the same reasons that everyone else in Europe is fed up. It's going to spill over into Italy. And if this happens, this weakens Germany's leadership position in the EU, and it could crack up. It's interesting to me right now, Catherine, that you see Merkel pressing very quietly, although very strongly, for the creation of this pan-European military, because this is the way that Germany is going to try and, you know, keep its thumbs on everybody else. And it was passed in the European Parliament. The interesting thing is they're going to make the British pay for part of it, you know, and I don't think that's going to go over too well in London. But I give it a 50-50 chance. And I really think the clue here, again, is what's happening to Deutsche Bank. I think it's partially explaining what's going on with the German gold repatriation. I think that they took some long-term steps back then to insulate themselves if they should ever have to reintroduce the D-mark.
Right.
So it could go that way.
If you look at what they're doing with sort of the Northern Europe,
yeah,
they could try and reconfigure the European Union as sort of a juggernaut of the Northern Europe. So the Netherlands, Germany, France.
Right.
You know, go without Britain, but the whole industrial sort of economic juggernaut across the North.
Right.
And if they pull an army together with that, then they can, I think they can continue to preserve something there that will be of value to that group.
Yeah, it would be effectively a return to the old snake arrangement, you know, with Germany, Austria,
right.
Luxembourg, the Netherlands.
Right.
If Europe does break up, the other consequence is that Germany will be forced to rearm in a major way. They're already planning to expand their military rather dramatically, but if Europe does break up, it's going to be an even bigger military that the Germans will want and probably get. It all depends, really at this point, it all depends on Marine Le Pen and how she does in the French elections. And if she does well,
right,
then it's going to spill over. So for now, I would say everybody should watch France very, very carefully.
Okay, so this is one I think a lot about, because as you know, I think the NYPD and Giuliani and the FBI New York office getting a hold of the Anthony Weiner laptop and
yes,
getting judicial permission to access it for the purpose of the Clinton Foundation investigation is what won the election for Trump. And if you look at the
mm-hmm.
stock market, the stock market started to trade that win literally the day after they got the laptop. And
yep,
it's interesting, Booz Allen Hamilton, which has been briefing Trump, started to trade up the next day. And then the day after that, Goldman Sachs started trading up.
Yep.
And in the month after that, 50% of the market increase was attributed to three stocks, one
yep.
of which was Goldman Sachs. So, so, you know, the stock market definitely tells you something about what was going on. So one of my big questions for the next year is, will Trump be able to use that information to get his agenda accomplished, or will that scandal blow up? And that I would include, you know, both Pizzagate and the pedophilia scandals, but also the money laundering of whatever was being done through the foundation.
Oh, I definitely think, as we said in part one, I definitely think that this hands Trump a huge amount of political leverage. And all he has to do, quite literally, all he has to do to get Congress in line with his agenda is merely threaten to have the DOJ start investigations. You know, U.S. Marshal Service, Secret Service, FBI, and so on and so forth. That's really all he has to do. I suspect very strongly that he is going to initiate some sort of investigation into some of these things. I would think, given what he said during the campaign, I would think that those investigations would take the form of investigating voter fraud, perhaps passing some federal standards for elections, doing something of that sort. I really fully expect him to initiate some sort of investigation, not only into the foundations, but into media donations and so on to the Clinton campaign. I really even expect that he might even start thinking in terms of an investigation of Soros and his foundation and his activities. And that would send powerful messages. Just those three investigations alone would send powerful messages to the people in Congress that, you know, I've got other stuff too that I can start investigating if you really want me to. So I think he's going into this not only with a lot of political capital from the election itself, but he's gained tremendously from the New York police thing. And I don't see him sitting on it, Catherine. He just doesn't strike me as the sort of individual that takes personal attack sitting down. So I really do expect that he's going to have some sort of investigations going. I really do. He wouldn't have appointed the people to the Department of Justice that he's been appointing. He wouldn't be appointing the people in the military that he's been appointing without having something like that in his mind.
Right. Although I tend to think he's going to use it much more to get what he wants than to try and
have I do too.
A public airing. I don't think he's looking for a public airing unless he's
right.
forced to it. Okay. One,
right.
I just have to ask you, you know, the question that I have on the web presentation is, what's going to happen between Pope Francis and the Vatican? But the question I really want to ask is, what's up with Pope Francis?
Well,
oh my God.
Yeah, he's, you know, he literally is not, from anything I can tell, adherent to any of the central tenets of Roman Catholicism. He's a plant of some sort. and he's, yeah, I'm quite serious. You know, I was suspicious of this after Benedict XVI resigned, you know, a German pope, and then all of a sudden we're electing the Cardinal Archbishop of Buenos Aires, you know, so connect those dots as you will. But, and being a Jesuit besides, you know, the Jesuit order, the late Father Malachi Martin, who himself was a Jesuit, wrote a book exposing its extreme leaning toward liberation theology, Marxism, and so on and so forth. You know, so I was suspicious of that when Francis was elected. What you're seeing now, and I just received an email as we've been talking about Francis dismissing some people, ordering a certain cardinal to dismiss three priests. I haven't read the whole thing. But what's shaping up in the Vatican is you're seeing a real struggle between Francis and the cardinalate that actually runs the day-to-day operations of the Vatican City. And there's been some very quiet pushback against him, and it's spreading. This could lead ultimately, if he's not careful, it could lead to the supreme sanction. And if people don't know what that is, that's when a pope becomes so far out that the cardinals simply shut down the bureaucracy. They just refuse to go along with anything anymore. So it's a real tug of war. The other thing about Francis that I find very, very interesting is that recently he came out with some sort of statement that it's necessary for the entire world to have a central bank. So in other words, it looks to me like he's the pope of the bankers. And once again, you know, I think the reasons there are clear. If you're going to have a global central bank, you're going to have some sort of moral sanction behind it. And the Vatican, you know, is the perfect place to go to get that. So, and as far as the papacy and its claims itself are concerned, you know, that's right up their line. So you're going to see, I think, a real tug of war now inside of Roman Catholicism between more traditionally minded people and bishops, particularly, and Francis himself. It could get very, very, very messy. Let's not forget, back in the Middle Ages, when these sorts of things occurred, you actually ended up with cardinals in full revolt that would elect an anti-pope. So at certain points in the Middle Ages, you actually had two different popes, both out of communion with each other. And at one point in the Middle Ages, you actually had three. So, you know, each of whom claiming to be the sole and infallible vicar of Christ, you know, which, as far as the Orthodox Church is concerned, is the problem. But anyway.
You know, I just have to come back to a different, I want to come back to Obama. Because, as you know, in 2008, when Obama started to run, I said, okay, this guy's been profiled, and the bankers want somebody to come in who's sort of a young, cool Ninja Turtle kind of guy,
right.
And he's gonna clean up all the financial fraud, stick it all to the taxpayer, and get the liberals to go along with it,
and the
right.
Democrats and the progressives and the young people. And they're not going to notice that this guy just engineered a consolidation of the financial coup d'etat, which was
right.
Taking all the retirement money in the country and giving it to the banks. And everybody's going to go along with it because this young, hip, black guy is going to, you know, do it. So
right.
This is the banker's candidate, and this has all been profiled by the CIA fake news guys. Anyway, so sure enough, he comes in. He turns $27 trillion over to the banks, the equivalent of, you know, double our retirement savings, gives it all to the banks, then comes up with all the, you know, the raping of these different places, Libya, Haiti,
right.
You know, continued special operations in Africa, the genocide, Ebola continues, you know, so, I mean, he out-Cheney's Cheney, and then we come up with Obamacare, so... if you look at the Rockefeller's agenda, this guy's absolutely done a fantastic job.
Yeah, he has.
Getting the American people to think it was cool and groovy to give to, you know, their entire retirement savings, or double their entire retirement savings to the banks for free. It's quite amazing. You know, it's an amazing political feat. Okay, so he's done everything they've asked and more. He's done a pretty good job. He failed on TPP and he couldn't get Clinton elected president. That was pretty ugly. But otherwise, he's done a great job. Now, if you're the Rockefellers, wouldn't he be the perfect fall guy to blame? You know, if all these pension funds are going through controlled demolition, say, hey, don't blame us. It was, you guys wanted a black guy to run the country, and look what happens when you turn things over to black people.
Yep.
You know.
Exactly.
This is why, right. So he's, in the last month, he's been looking and acting since the election, scared to death.
Yep.
And yep. The question is he starting to smell that he's going to be the fall guy?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Because his behavior has become increasingly irrational. You know, people are saying he's petulant. No, I think what you're watching is a scared man. Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's put it this way. I don't see him on the lecture circuit like Bill Clinton. And the same for Michelle. She's trying to position herself, I think, as the next Oprah, and I think that's not in the cards either. There's real panic there. And like you say, I think he's being set up to be the fall guy. And again, you know, that's the old liberal East Coast establishment racism at work once again. You know, it's been
right
there all along. It's still there. I think that's exactly what's going on here. I'll tell you what I think is going to happen, Catherine, over the next 4 years. I think you're going to see a spate of books and articles uncovering all the dirty little things that have not yet been adequately aired.
Right.
I think you're going to see a revival of the birther controversy. I think you're going to see a revival of the allegations that appeared very briefly during his 2008 campaign about homosexual liaisons. I think it's all going to come crawling out of the woodwork. And I think it's going to happen rather quickly, to be frank with you.
Well, he's certainly acting uncharacteristically afraid.
Yep.
And it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, if you look at the guys who put him in, that's exactly the kind of thing they do.
Yep.
Now, I will say this. I think one of the biggest, most important questions for me for 2017, we've seen the CIA and their news and media network promulgate fake news. I mean, it's quite remarkable. And they've engineered a soft revolution sort of effort globally with fake news that was very clever in many respects. I mean, I find it very distasteful, but it certainly has been very successful. But what we're seeing now is, for some reason, that machinery, you know, the dam is cracked, and
yep.
You're seeing them. One commentator the other day said it was like watching an elephant die screaming. They're certainly in a very, what looks to me to be a very ugly death spiral. But
yeah,
is there anything?
I think so.
Yeah. So am I just being hopeful that they will continue in their death spiral? Is there any hope for them? Or
oh no, I don't think you're being hopeful. I think there's actually real evidence to suggest that the rest of the intelligence community. You know, people tend to think of the American intelligence community as the FBI and the CIA. But you have to remember, you've got a whole spate of agencies, the Defense Intelligence
right.
Agency, Office of Naval Intelligence, Army Intelligence, Marine Intelligence, Air Force Intelligence, NSA, not to mention State Department Intelligence. I think what you're seeing, Catherine, quite frankly, and this is what kind of intrigues me about some of Mr. Trump's advisors and appointments, I think what you're seeing is that the CIA has basically been walled off by the rest of the intelligence and military community. I think they've kind of closed ranks with each other and are shutting the CIA out of the picture. And I also think, quite frankly, that there is probably a very large segment of the CIA itself that has been looking at the direction of things that has been taken, you know, since the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, that have been looking at all of this and saying we need to go in an absolutely different direction. So I think there's a deep factional schism within the American intelligence community, and that you're looking at pushback, quite frankly, against that element of the CIA that's been behind a lot of this shenanigans. I think you're looking at huge pushback. In fact, you know, you had claims of that nature being put out by Steve Pachenik during the election, and of course he's deeply connected with the CIA and has been involved in covert operations, and came right out and basically said, yeah, you know, I'm speaking for a group of people that are just not going to let this soft coup continue. I think that's exactly what you're looking at. I don't think it's hopeful at all. I think you're looking at a fundamental shift in the center of power within the intelligence community in this country.
Right. I do too. Well, I think, you know, the people who are responsible to make things happen on the ground, again, I think the people more involved in the concrete aspect of reality,
right,
are putting their foot down.
Right.
Now, my hope is that what we're going to see is the cash flows being cut to the unproductive on a regular and steady basis from here on out.
I think that's in the cards.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a lot of candidates on that list, but let's see what
happens. Okay. I bet you do.
There are a couple of major media commentators that they just need to go get a job. You know, my plan for everybody is that after they're indicted and prosecuted, that they, rather than costing us $154,000 a year to put them in prison, we assign them all to working at Motel 6 as cleaning ladies and cleaning men. And so, you know, whatever their sentences, you know, whether it's 2 years or 20 years, at the end of their 2 and 20 year sentences, they come out and re-explain to us what the meaning of deplorable is. So
yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well,
anyway,
you know,
I'm going to ask you
after we're off the record, who is on your list in the media? Because I bet you.
Well, I'll tell you who I get the most frustrated with is some of the African American attorneys and commentators, because the Clintons were, and the Democrats were, so instrumental. It was bipartisan, but it was a Democratic administration that really led the prison, you know, the creation and building of the prison industrial complex.
Yep.
And if you see over the last 25 years what has been done to the African American neighborhoods, it's awful. It's just awful. And it was led by many of these, you know, the Eric Holders of this world, who got huge prestigious positions and then partnerships in fancy law firms, and they've made a fortune all fronting for this genocide. And I believe, you know, to me it's genocide. You bring in the drugs, you entrap the kids, you put them in prison. It's genocide to the neighborhoods, it's genocide to the kids, and then it's taxpayer prison for the taxpayers. I mean, it's a lose-lose-lose all around, and you have this whole group of sort of African-Americans fronting for it in the media and in the enforcement line and making it look progressive. And yeah. I really don't know how they look themselves in the mirror.
Frankly, you know, it's a form of soft slavery. This has always been my problem with the Democratic Party. This is the party of slavery. And the attitude is deeply embedded, and it's carefully disguised. And you stop and think of, again, in speaking in terms of human productivity, you stop and think about how this is damaging people that could offer creative solutions to things by
right.
doing this sort of thing. You know, it has never made sense to me, ever made sense to me. You know, we just saw the retirement of Dr. Thomas Sowell. And, you know, he was kind of, for many years, just kind of this lonely voice in the African-American community of trying to get some sanity to this whole problem. And, you know, God bless him for toughing it out, because, you know, he was called all sorts of names. You
right.
know, Uncle Tom and everything else. And to me, it's just abominable, because it's a soft form of slavery. It's just pure, unadulterated bigotry, and it's no wonder you saw the backlash, I think, that you saw against them in this last election. You know, you looked at those Trump rallies that were packing stadiums, and you saw every demographic in those rallies, which really... When Hillary came out with her basket of deplorables, I think that was one comment that absolutely sank her, among many
right.
others. But if one looks at just one comment that absolutely sank her, you know, she eventually came out and apologized. But so what? That was what her real heart was.
I don't know if you realize this, but the Russians made her do it.
The Russians what?
The Russians made her do it. It was really the Russians.
Yes, the evil Mr. Putin and his Machiavellian genius are behind it all. Yes, I know. It's just, you know, it's reaching such hysteria levels, Catherine. You know, it's like the people that think the Masons are behind it all, or the Jesuits, or, you know, it's absurd. It just is absurd.
Well, let me, before we close down on unanswered questions, I think one of the most important things that the challenges we're facing over the next few years is the rebalancing of the relationship between America and China.
Yes.
And the global economy depends on that succeeding. In other words, it's like two Siamese twins. We can have a war, but I'm not sure we're going to be better for the war. So,
oh no.
So to me, the question is, can that rebalancing work, and can we find a way to cooperate and compete with China effectively when they're becoming, because of their size, and Asia's becoming an 800-pound gorilla?
I think it can. Again, I go back to what I said last week, that we have tremendous opportunity, if we play our cards correctly, with nations in the Pacific Rim, like Indonesia, which is a crucially important nation, because you're dealing there with a secularized Islamic state that is not radical, and is, in point of fact, is very, very skeptical of radical Islamic states like Saudi Arabia. I think Indonesia is crucially important here, but also Vietnam with its own inherent dislike through, you know, long historical experience, dislike of China. I think we have golden opportunities here in Thailand, Vietnam, and so on in the Pacific Rim to really make some beneficial trade deals. And, you know, I think Trump has already indicated that he is open to those kinds of thoughts when he took that call from the president of Taiwan. So I think that's in the cards. But China itself, we are going to have to deal directly with him. And there was something very interesting that I saw as a story this last week, Catherine, and that was that China has apparently even offered help in this big infrastructure project that Mr. Trump is talking about. Japan's already on board. I forget which Japanese bank has already pledged about $50
billion. SoftBank. Yeah, SoftBank.
Right. China came out and said that it would be willing to do that. And I think if he plays his cards right, that's kind of an opening there. I think that was China saying, okay, look, we don't want confrontation. Let's try and do something together here. I think you can have some tremendous opportunities there. You know, China has been talking for years about trying to help to build a high-speed rail connection between the Los Angeles area and Las Vegas. So there's a possibility there that this can be worked out, but it's going to take some cool heads in Washington and Beijing to get away from the rhetoric and down to some real actual hard negotiations about all of this.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, Abe's a deal guy. Trump's a deal guy. The Chinese are deal guys. The Chinese are all deal guys. It's unbelievable.
Yep, exactly.
You know, whether it's gambling or doing deals, that's what they love to do. And
yep.
One of my favorite quotes of the year was Jack Ma saying, you know, when trade stops, war starts.
Yep.
So I think what we need to do is we all need to get, you know, to get to work just doing deals and get so busy building stuff together that we can't afford to have. You know, we don't have time to fight because we're too busy building things.
Right,
that's
exactly.
That's what has to happen, right. And that's
how
you create a positive return on investment.
Well, there's another little bit of news here that I think factors into this. China, I just got an email prior to our interview. China apparently has sent now the first freight train to Britain.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
Wow.
Wow. No more Malacca Straits. Now stop and think of that, folks. You know, a train from Shanghai, all the way through Europe, through the Channel, and into Great Britain.
Wow.
Wow.
You know they made that deal when they had dinner. Remember that dinner when I said the Chinese made a deal around the Americans? There it is. Yeah, there's the proof.
There's the proof right there.
Yep.
And, you know, it doesn't take much imagination to see that we don't need this confrontational attitude with the Chinese, nor they with us. Again, I think it's going to require some real cagey diplomacy on Trump's part, that he's going to have to, if he, insofar as he is confrontational with China, it has to be through the soft approach, trade deals with those nations in the Pacific Rim, and some very, very careful diplomacy with Russia. Russia here, again, is, you know, kind of sitting in the catbird seat, because the closer the United States moves to Russia, this is going to budge the Chinese off of that confrontational perch, because they cannot afford a combination like that. So, you know, we've got real geopolitical opportunity here if we play our cards correctly. And I think, you know, again, the statements of Brzezinski and the reemergence of Mr. Kissinger on the scene talking about patching things up with Russia, this is a huge sign that this is exactly what's going to happen. So I'm kind of optimistic in the long term on these geopolitical fronts. What really interests me with respect to China is what Mr. Trump is going to propose and say in his State of the Union address when he has to lay out the details of all of these infrastructure and reshoring projects that he has in mind, because that's going to be the clue for us as to how he's going to have to approach things in the Pacific Rim. So that's what we're going to have to watch. And, you know, unfortunately, we're not doing this after his State of the Union speech, so we're having to kind of read the tea leaves again. But I think we're going to be in for some surprises in that speech that are going to have some big, big, huge geopolitical implications over the long term. So, you know, stay tuned.
Well, the question we finished last year's unanswered questions with, that is still on the list, this year, and I'll close with this, is who is really in control? You know, we continue to live on a planet where the governance system, the real governance system, is a complete mystery.
Yeah.
And I've certainly spent a lifetime trying to figure out a logical explanation for what's going on here. I have one ally who insists it's all being run by AI.
Well, who knows? It may be. But in terms of the components of it, obviously, the central banks remain hugely influential. The intelligence, the worldwide intelligence community remains, I think, hugely influential behind the scenes because they're all networked with each other. I mean, they spy on each other, but they cooperate to an amazing degree as well. And I think that's part of what we're looking at. But I have to be honest, Catherine, in studying all this over the years, even back when I was in graduate and postgraduate work, looking at all of this, I have come to the conclusion that there has to be some off-planet component of this that we're not being told about.
Right.
There's too much weirdness
right.
that really can't be rationalized in any other way. I think you've got huge hidden players on this planet. You know, what I've been calling Nazi or Fascist International, I think that's definitely a player. It explains a lot of things that don't make sense otherwise, particularly in Europe. But, you know, add all that together, and I still think that you've got this big, huge, empty center that the puzzle pieces haven't been filled in because we don't have those pieces in our pile on the table. And that means, to my way of thinking, that there's an aspect of this that's off-planet, be it of a spiritual nature, which, you know, would certainly be part of many major religious traditions in the world, or of a more mundane nature. But there's something else going on, and I think the whole Antarctica story is kind of an indicator that there's a big, huge something else going on. Because
right.
if you're going to hide an interface like that, that would be the one place on the planet where you would do it.
Right, and we certainly know a phenomena happening there over many decades that fits with possibility.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think we've got plenty to chew on throughout 2017. There's lots to research and figure out. And we keep getting closer. You know, there are more people working on this and they're more integrating. So let's turn to our final section, which is inspiration. And that is, as one of our allies, wonderful allies, said, there are more and more heroes these days. So there was a lot in 2016 to inspire us, but maybe if you could just touch on some of the things during 2016 that really inspired you.
Well, I have to be quite honest and say that it was the rise that we've seen happening over the last couple of years, but particularly last year, the rise of an awareness of the importance of Western civilization and of the importance of maintaining it. This, and again, this is a cultural issue, and I'm adamant that what we're seeing in terms of backlash in Europe, in terms of backlash against Mr. Global in North America and elsewhere in the world, I'm convinced that this is a cultural phenomenon, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And you have similar signs of it, you know, even in places like China. Certainly Mr. Putin has made this very, very clear that this is part of his agenda, front and center, is the cultural issue. I think that's the most encouraging thing. I was very, very heartened at the way Mr. Wilders in the Netherlands has been handling himself and the way he's been talking over the past couple of years. He's taken great pains to avoid inflammatory language and to stress the central tenets of our Western culture. I think you certainly see this in the people at the popular level, at the grassroots level, backing Mr. Trump. You see a phenomenon here that's transcending every demographic group, and that in part I think is what was responsible for throwing the polls so off center in this country, besides the fact that they were deliberately skewing them. I don't think they really understood or tapped into the fact that what you're seeing is a huge cultural realignment rather than simply a political one. And this is why the corporate media have been left out in the cold. They're thinking of this strictly political terms, and it's not. So that to me was hugely, hugely positive, I think. There's always danger in these types of things that they can easily degenerate very quickly into forms of fascism. But so far, I think we've dodged that bullet, but that danger remains, and we're going to have to be alive to it. But the other thing that I thought was very, very positive is that you do see more and more exposure of issues like vaccines coming out. You see more and more websites popping up dealing with all of these things and not afraid to address them. That to me is hugely positive. The reaction of the progressives, of Mr. Global and so on, their panicked reaction, I think, is very positive, because that means that they are in serious trouble, and that's a positive sign. So even the negative responses to the Brexit and to Trump's election and so on, I think can be viewed in a positive way. So there's a lot positive to look at that's inspiring. And like I put it before, I think the most interesting and possibly inspiring thing to come out of this is we're going to see, by the nature of the case, we're going to see some real cultural reflection and real cultural creativity and activity, because the opportunity for it is now there.
Right. Well, I don't know if you saw it, but I put a quote on the web presentation, and inspiration is one of my favorite quotes from the Orson Welles movie, The Third Man.
Third Man, and, yes.
And one of the characters says, like the fellow says, in Italy for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love, they had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did they produce? The cuckoo clock.
Yep. Exactly.
Now, I have a great love for Switzerland, so that's the one thing I have to confess. But I do feel that for 20 years I've been battling, or my whole life really, I've been battling this enormous push for inhumanity, which fronts itself with all sorts of, you know, propaganda about human values or human virtues, and but it's terribly inhuman, and the people who lead it believe in slavery, are committed to slavery, and now they have fantastic technology, and I feel like finally we're starting to see a crack in the dam, where, and this is why the news, the corporate news failing is so important, where you have enough people saying, wait a minute, you know, what, and it's on 20, 30, 40 different issues. Just this is wrong. This is inhuman. No. And of course, the other thing I have to say, which I'm very grateful to Joseph, is, you know, by the time the election came, I thought my life expectancy, if the Democrats won, was going to be maybe 1 or 2 years. I didn't think.
Yeah, me too. Quite frankly, I was afraid.
Right.
I was genuinely afraid.
Well, I think there was good reason to. I think you had a lot of reason to be genuinely afraid, and that the body count was growing steadily throughout the election.
Yep.
So, you know, but it was clear that the Democrats were going to come in with lists, and a lot of people were going to get destroyed, whether it was fast or slow. So, you know, I'm personally grateful to be alive and to be looking forward to a long life. Although, you know, who we never know what's going to happen next. The one thing I do want to close with is that one of the things that kept me sane this year was working on the J.P. Farrell virtual pipe organ. And I don't know why Chuck McCorkle and I were the co-sponsors. And we've been having a blast. But while all this, you know, unbelievable corruption is flying around and unbelievably perverted goings-on and behavior, we're sitting there trying to learn about the history of pipe organs. And it was kind of a sanctuary, you know, and for not just for me, but the whole Soleri, you know, because the whole Soleri team has been involved and we've learned an awful lot about music. Anyway, but I do, in closing, I do want to let everybody know we're very excited because one of the original donors has offered a match for January. We're going to be mailing it this month. And for the month of January, up until the time we hit the funding of phase one, they've offered to match very generously. So, Joseph, I'm very encouraged that we're gonna fund phase one, and you're going to be practicing away by the end of February if we can get the time.
Well, I have to tell you again, I'm just absolutely gobsmacked. I really am at the response that you've got thus far. I'm just literally stunned, and needless to say, I'm very, very grateful. Because it's been kind of a dream of mine for many, many years is to somehow get back to regular practice and making music part of my life again. But, you know, I have a friend, I mentioned this in the previous interview, that he and his wife go out and perform music at local restaurants and so on. And he told me today that for him it's a return to sanity, you know, that it's his true self. And I, you know, I can really fully understand that because if you've played an instrument or sung, you know, in your life, it really does center you, and it's you know, music is the oldest art. You know, the oldest cave paintings are about 29,000 years old, but we've found evidence of flutes that are several thousand years older. So, you know, it's been a part of humanity for a very, very long time, and going without it is you know, it's rather difficult. But I'm just absolutely stunned at the response, and I want to thank everybody, you know, once again that's already made donations to it, because I never expected in my wildest dreams, never.
Well, I, you know, I'm not surprised. There's many, many wonderful donors, and they've been incredibly supportive, both with their donations and their prayers and their comments, and it's been a wonderful process. But I think the reason I'm so, it's so important to me, is that if we are going to make this change and move into a human and yet productive society, then we have to prove that we can support artists and scholars who really support the, you know, ideas and knowledge that is for the best intention of all concerned. And you said earlier, Joseph, and I agree that unfortunately the universities, despite all their massive funding, are, you know, less and less a safe haven for the kind of scholars and artists who can invent the pathway forward. And if I believe that people really will support those scholars and artists. And for me, this was a kind of way of proving to you that it was so.
Well, that's one reason I'm so surprised, and pleasantly so, is that I think that's a kind of a reinforcement that people understand or are beginning to understand how important our culture is, and its worth and its preservation. You know, and I really do hope that out of this comes more projects like this for teachers, you know, that need books for their classrooms or private tutors and so on and so forth. because I think that's going to be what sustains us in part through the coming rough period. It's going to have to. And like your quotation from that movie says, you know, it was out of the strife around the Borgias that you had the Michelangelos and Da Vincis and De Medicis, Cosimo de Medici, and so on, that created all of this. So it's worth preserving. I don't think for a moment it isn't worth preserving. It is. You know, pipe organs to me are fascinating, you know, for a number of reasons, but, you know, they're the oldest keyboard instrument and central in that respect, central to the development of our Western system of music. You can't really understand it without them. So it's kind of a centerpiece culturally, this amazing feat of engineering that these people way back then came up with. Hugely well, complex, intricate things.
And as I pointed out, if you watch all the movies on space, it is the instrument of space.
Yeah, it is. For some reason, it's very, very weird that, you know, you have all this music in those movies. Yeah, it really is. It's very weird.
Well, the galaxy is a powerful concept. You need a powerful instrument to match the, you know, the cosmic scope. Well, Joseph, before we close, any thoughts of advice for 2017? What should our subscribers and members be preparing for?
Well, I think they have to look very carefully and keep control over their finances, and by that I mean be able to have access to cash, have their money in institutions that they know and that they trust, and hopefully not big corporate ones. That would be my first thing. My second bit of advice or intuition would be to look at all of the things that we've discussed and try to see creative opportunities for investment in them, and that would go particularly for people in the Pacific, because I think the opportunities are going to be multiplying like rabbits over the next few years in the Pacific. In this country, I think people have to, again, we've talked about this many times, they're going to have to figure out ways how they can be individually responsible for the preservation of Western culture in whatever niche or area that they feel inclined to like, and to pass it down and to become active in some sort of creative fashion, you know, because I think that it's creativity that's going to get us through this, in other words. And so anything that nourishes that intellectually or in terms of activity that's going to give you extra finances or whatever, extra peace or anything of this sort, that has to be central to what we do. It's going to be a creative effort. So we've got to start focusing on human productivity. And you know, I'm very, very heartened because I see a lot of young people where I'm at doing that sort of thing, trying to figure out, you know, how can I be productive and creative, and you know, because it's the young people I feel sorry for, because the job market and job environment is so pathetically bad. And a lot of them I see turning to things like the arts or whatever that they find some creative enjoyment out of. And I think that's going to be the pattern of the future. Like it or not, we're just going to have to find a way to monetize it. That's the real problem.
Well, that's the, I don't know, I think it can be done. So.
Oh, I do too, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, well, I can't thank you enough for joining us for News, Trends, and Stories. It always takes us a while to chew through, but I have to tell you, I think this is an unprecedented period of change.
Yep.
And this is not going to be another year of slow burn. This is going to be, you know, the motto we had on my last company was Rocco et Rotula, which was sort of bastardized Latin for rock and roll.
Yep.
This is 2017 is going to be the year of rock and roll. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining Joseph and me on the Solera Report, and I look forward to talking to you next week. Joseph, you have a wonderful evening.
Yep, you too, Catherine.